This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 98-year-old Del Byler of Hollister, California, originally from rural western Kansas, where once upon a time he used to ride his horse 7 miles to his one-room schoolhouse. During World War II, he was operating a little more horsepower as a Navy fighter pilot. He had trained in F-6F Hellcats and was about to head overseas in August of 1944, when the top 10% of his class was siphoned off for night fighter training, learning to take off and land on carriers in the dark. Before he eventually headed overseas, he got married. But I got to get that whole story, Del. How'd you first meet your wife, Jeannie?
I met her in Chicago at a dinner party. She was a very attractive young woman, but she was so young. I thought, oh, she's a pretty young girl, but she's too young for me. And she wasn't too sure. Anyway, we went together for 4 years, and we got married. And we were married for over 60 years, and she's been passed away for 12 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 6 children, and we had a wonderful marriage. I was very fortunate in my flying and very fortunate in my marriage.
Well, I'm just curious. I mean, you guys decided to get married right before you were going to go overseas. And you don't know how long the war's going to last.
We were married when I was at Martha's Vineyard, the final stages of night flying in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, ready to go overseas. And we decided to get married then. And Dick LeBar, my best man, and I flew in military planes to Grosse Ile. I had 5 days leave to get married. That's a terrible, one of the worst things ever happened to me. The day of our marriage, we were at the hotel. It was a big hotel, it covered a square block in Detroit. Dick lived near Detroit. He had a car and a steady girlfriend. So he went to see his girlfriend and he came back and I said, your uniform needs pressing, Dick. He said, I'll get it pressed while you go check out. So I went to check out, but the hotel has 4 entrances. I went to one entrance, Dick went to the other. We missed each other. Finally, I took a taxi to the wedding. I was 12 minutes late for my own wedding.
And she still married you, huh?
Yeah, Dick LeBar. Anyway, to kind of culminate that, Dick got killed not too soon after that, coming aboard a carrier. I was not on that carrier at that time. But Dick landed aboard the carrier, made a successful landing. But these are straight deck carriers, much more dangerous than canted decks. Straight deck carriers, you land, you only have half the ship to use. Amidships is the big fence. They dropped the big fence. Dick taxied up here, ready to go down, take the elevator down. And the guy behind him, the pilot behind him, landed aboard with hung ordnance. You're not supposed to have hung ordnance. It's too dangerous for landing. And as he landed, the ordnance came loose, skittered across the deck, and killed Dick.
Mm.
It wasn't his fault. He was just getting out of his plane.
Yeah, that had to be devastating news for you.
Well, anyway, those things happen. It's not the safest vocation in the world.
And now you're ready to head overseas yourself. The war's still going on in the Pacific, but you're going to have to say goodbye to your new bride and, as far as you know, go risk your life, right?
Well, that was a separate and, I think, kind of an interesting part of my life. I went overseas. I was stationed at Barbers Point and was flying to the carriers. We were supposed to go aboard the Enterprise for the invasion of Japan, and that was the biggest armada I had ever seen. We had collected ships and pilots and planes from different islands and different places in the Pacific. That armada stretched from horizon to horizon. You wouldn't believe it. And we were in the center because I was aboard the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
That was Admiral Sherman's flagship. And you look in any direction and nothing but warships.
Mm.
We were going in. I don't think any human could have stopped us.
Mm.
We would have lost a lot of men, and the Japanese would have lost a lot of men.
Oh,
but
God.
About halfway over, they dropped the atomic bombs and said, the war's over, go home. And that was fine, and I was on the right ship at the right time. So they turned the Enterprise around with escort carriers, a couple of cruisers, and several destroyers, and shot us through the canal for Navy Day. And that's a separate story.
Well, you can tell that story, but I am interested what the celebration was like when you heard that Japan had surrendered. Was there a big celebration on the Big E?
Not so. Everybody was happy. We were all happy because the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
We're going home. It's kind of interesting on the way to New York for Navy Day. Off Atlantic City, the captain of the Enterprise said, any of you fighter pilots that want to fly into New York a day early, raise your hand. Send me in, Coach.
You didn't hesitate, huh?
No. So we went in a day early and landed. And Jeannie, my wife, my bride, didn't know that I was coming a day early. So her dad, Manly Chestnut, he lived at this hotel. He gave us his room at the hotel and went someplace else. So we had a good place to stay.
Well, where'd you surprise her? She didn't know you were coming into New York City, huh?
She didn't know I was coming. That was one of the best events I ever had. Her dad and I, she was getting in Grand Central Station. She was coming off the train. Her dad went up to greet her, and I kind of hid halfway behind a post or something. She threw her arms around her dad, of course. Maybe shouldn't have done it. I came up beside her and said, carry your bags, lady. And she flipped. She recognized my voice. We had a great time in New York. We were footloose, fancy free, and had everything at our disposal.
Sounds like a scene from a movie or something, doesn't it? Grand Central Station?
Yeah.
Surprise greeting when the war's over?
That's right, it was.
Were you ever at all disappointed that you didn't personally get to go over there and fly combat missions with all the time that you put in training and all the investment you had?
I didn't have a chance to shoot down any enemy planes. I did a lot of flying, and when I was ready.
So World War II's over. You're released from active duty. Did you think you'd ever be flying military planes again?
Not at that point, Paul, but I was married. We were starting our family. Mm-hmm. I had two wonderful children, Diane and Jan, and I didn't have any money, and I liked to fly. So I joined the Ready Reserve again. I'd fly some Hellcats, but I was flying FH-1s, which was predecessor to the FH-2, and F-8F. F-8 was an interesting plane. I made a dead stick landing once in an F-8F, but...
Well, you can't just say that. You got to tell me the story. What happened?
I'll get around to it. Let me finish this a little bit.
Okay.
If I may. I started because I needed the money, and I liked to fly. So I was in the Ready Reserve and flying F-8s, FH-1s, F-2H-3s, Banshees and stuff, and it was good. All of a sudden, the career came along, and they ordered our whole squadron to report. Anybody under a certain age, and with not three children, but I had two, report for active duty, which I did. So I was in Korea. But the F-8 is kind of interesting because I did make a dead stick landing in an F-8. It was trying out the plane at Glenview. It just been through maintenance, and I was by myself, just flying by myself. I was flying over the North Shore, which is populated, as you know.
Yeah, you're talking about Chicago for folks who didn't pick up on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
North Shore Chicago is very populated.
Uh-huh.
But I was west of Chicago a little bit. All of a sudden, a major oil line broke in this darn thing. And I had oil all over my windshield. And I knew enough, it was a heavy flow of oil. I knew enough that this plane ain't going to land, fly very long without oil. So I just got all the altitude I could, headed back toward Glenview, and told them I was going to make an emergency landing if I could. So it did quit. But I had enough altitude and I was close enough to feel that I made it without an engine.
Were you gritting your teeth a little bit on that landing? Were you nervous that you wouldn't quite make the runway?
Really, I wasn't really nervous. It's either you make it or you die, one of the two. Which is it? So I never thought about being nervous then. I'm sure I was.
Mm-hmm.
But I made it. And I came in high and hot, landed the plane on one of the runways at Glenview, burned up the brakes on the runway. At the end of the runway, I started to a little more speed than I wanted, so I ground looped it. Never scratched paint on the plane, but I burned up the brakes.
Sounds like a good pilot. Sounds like some skill at work there. I'm sure this all went by very quickly, but you mentioned how populated the area you're flying over is. I mean, there had to be a moment where You're concerned that it might not just be you that dies.
You don't blame it. And if you have any conscience, you don't bail out of a plane and let it fall where it's going to fall. It could fall on a church. It could fall on a school. It's going to probably kill somebody.
But technically, that was an option for you. You could have bailed out and saved yourself, knowing that others would have died.
It would have been safer. It would have been safer, if that's your question, yeah.
So you risked your own life to make sure you didn't claim any others.
Well, the best option was to get that plane back to Glenview.
And you made it.
I made it without an engine. Mm-hmm. And part of the way. At the very end, I had no engine.
Mm-hmm. So what's the no radio story?
That's after the Korean War. We came back to Glenview, and we were a Banshee squadron, F-283 squadron at that point, and it was all the time in Korea.
And a lot of people might not be familiar with that plane. It's not one of the more well-known planes. What can you tell us about the Banshee?
The Banshee is a twin-engine plane made by McDonnell. It's a twin-engine, and it's a heavy plane. Another guy and I flew to Detroit. And coming back, we landed to refuel to make it all the way to the Moffett Field. The afternoon they were to take off for Moffett, he downed his plane, and I was anxious to get back. So I took off anyway and was flying solo at night over Salt Lake City. My radio went out. My electrical system went out. I didn't have lights. I didn't have a radio. And I was headed back to Moffett. So the only thing to do is just continue. And if this were the tower, I couldn't radio in that I was in trouble to give me a clear landing strip. So I buzzed the tower. You fly by at tower level as fast as you can at night. It gets the attention of the people there.
I would say so.
I made a landing okay. Then the summation of that flight was kind of scary because going into the radio room, which was one of the hangars at Moffett Field, my anti-G suit felt kind of squishy. It didn't feel normal. And I checked, and the darn thing was full of gas. Glenview, the maintenance people had made a mistake. You have hydraulic pressure to your gas tanks and the wings and things, and also hydraulic pressure for your anti-gravity suit. And somebody installed something wrong in there. My suit that I was wearing was full of air and gas and aviation gas. It kind of scared me. I guess I wasn't around any sparks to set it off, but still it wasn't a very good thing to have happen.
Good thing you didn't light a match.
No, I would have gone up in a big flame.
Well, and you know, we talked about World War II, and you spent most of the war training and were overseas on your way to hit Japan when the war ended. I'm sure people hear you mentioning the Korean War, and they're wondering what kinds of things you were doing in those planes during the Korean War.
I flew over again. They never came up to meet us over Korea.
Uh-huh.
I flew over Korea. I spent time on the deck there as a guest of the Air Force, but I was fortunate in a way in that I hit the hot spot right after the armistice. Yeah. After the armistice in Korea, we never dropped any bombs in anger, but we were flying over Korea. I was on the Essex at that time, straight deck carrier Essex. And they sent us to the Asian theater, cruising right off the coast of Vietnam. And we were we'd go to the Philippines and back to Vietnam. That was I had some interesting flights that way, but the most interesting part of that was the French were under siege at Dien Bien Phu while we were there. We were, as far as we're concerned, we went on war footing to help the French. They held up our mail home for 3 weeks. Our wives didn't know why, but there's no mail for 3 weeks. And we were flying over Dien Bien Phu off the carrier. This photograph is just before a cap hop that we flew. But you can see in this photo we were wearing sidearms, and the briefs that we had, we were briefed on escape and evasion. And in our planes, the main thing in our fighter planes, in the Banshees, we had full ammunition fed in to the chamber. You normally have full, the ammunition aboard gives us the right weight on the plane, but you sure don't have it fed in. We had ammunition fed in. All we had to do was flip a switch and pull the trigger We were in business. We had 20-millimeter cannon on the planes at that time, which was pretty powerful firepower.
And there were elements within the U.S. military complex that wanted you guys to use that firepower. Who knows what that would have led to and how it might have changed history. We're going to dive a little deeper into that when we come back. More from Del Byler's Navy flying days, as well as a more recent mission with Honor Flight Bay Area. Don't forget to check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.